Well, amen. We're going to look at three different passages of Scripture tonight. And the reason for that is because the story that I'm going to preach on tonight is mentioned in three different Gospels. And we're going to look at this story this evening, and we'll see a little bit of difference as far as details are concerned. When you put all of them together, you can get a full mosaic of the passage. We're going to read in just a few minutes out of Matthew chapter 8, if you want to begin to hold those places. Matthew chapter 8, Mark chapter 1, and our text for this evening will be out of the Gospel of Luke chapter number 4. And I want us to remember that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called synoptic gospels. And the reason that they're called that is because sometimes they have stories that are identical. They overlap with each other. They just simply give a little different point of view about the same story. You say, well, why do we have four different gospels? Well, because you have different authors or evangelists, some people call them, and they wrote to different groups. You have Matthew, and he wrote to the Jews, and he wrote from a Jewish perspective. Mark wrote to the Romans. He was trying to get the point across to those people in that Roman Empire. Then you have Luke, and he wrote to the Gentiles. And then you have John, and he wrote for the whole world. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Tonight, the story that we're going to look at has a sick lady that's in it. And do you know disease is a big, big part of society, no matter where it's at? You can go to the remote part of this world and you'll find people that are sick. You can go to the most affluent neighborhood in this country. And I don't know where that would be, but I think per capita, somewhere around Washington, D.C., has the highest median income of anybody. But yet, if you went up to somewhere outside of Washington around the northern Virginia suburbs, I guarantee you'll find sick people. It doesn't matter if you're in the ghetto or if you're in a penthouse, you're going to get sick. And the reason is because of sin. In 1950, the amount of money that was spent on health care and on people being sick, it amounted to 4.4% of the gross domestic product of America. In 2011, it was 17.9%. If you doubt that it's not going up, just look at what your hospitalization cost. I was talking with one of the ladies in our church, and she had retired from a well-known company here in our state. And over the years, she and her husband have been able to have the insurance through this particular large company. And this year, for the very first time, her health premiums were more than her retirement, and so they had to start putting money with her retirement just to be able to pay those premiums. It reminds me of the lady that had the issue of blood for 12 years. The Bible says that she spent all that she had on physicians and was none the better. And so you've got disease that is everywhere. You've got the majority of medicines that we know of today. Well, let me just say this. Modern medicine really did not even begin to take hold until really the 1800s. You think about during the Civil War. You had men having their legs and their arms sawed off without anesthesia. I mean, you've got guys that are being strapped down, and the next thing you know, you got a handsaw that's whacking off your leg. I mean, that is rough. What about George Washington? They almost killed our first president by bloodletting him. And you've got things like the polio vaccine. We take that for granted. But do you know that that vaccine was not developed until 1955? I was one year from being born when that vaccine was developed, but I was about 4 years old before it went into commercial use. And I literally went to school in elementary school and with one boy in high school that had polio when they were boys, and they never did walk right. And so modern medicine is basically a newcomer to the human race. And so when you begin to think about our passage tonight, and we see this sick lady and a miracle that begins to take place, I want you to understand how often miracles have taken place in history. You know, we have a tendency to just think, well, man, on all the pages of the Bible, I mean, it's just bam, bam. I mean, it's everywhere because we love preaching on it, all right? Did you know that from Genesis chapter 3 through Abraham was 2,200 years? Do you know during that 2,200-year span, do you know there was no miracles recorded in the Bible? No miracles. Well, let's take the next 1,500 years. You go from Abraham through Isaiah. Now, this included the prophets that we really brag a lot about, guys like Elijah and Elisha. You can take from Abraham through Isaiah, and you've probably got less than 30. If I'm remembering right, and I may not be since I'm tired today, but I want to say that Elijah performed 8 miracles in his life. Elisha had asked God to let him have a double portion, and he performed 15 miracles in his life. But then, about 100 years after he died, his bones had been placed in a cave. And a caravan was coming through. A guy dies. They take his body and they throw it in this cave. He touches the dead 100-year-old bones of Elisha, comes back to life and goes running out saying, hey, don't leave me, I'm okay. So there was a 16th miracle. So he got a double portion. So if you've got 16 and 8, that's 24. And let's just throw 6 more in just in case. But during that next 1,500 years, you've got less than 30 miracles that have taken place, even during those two great prophets. Well, what about from Isaiah until Jesus? 0. None. So basically, in all the Old Testament, from the beginning to the time that Jesus is born, you've got less than 30 miracles that have been performed. But then all of a sudden Jesus comes in and he begins his ministry, and I mean, it's like open season. And we're going to take somewhere between 35 and 37 miracles depending on how we break them down. Like, I'm going to stop tonight and not add what comes next tonight because I'm going to pick up on that next time I preach on a Wednesday. But when you begin to see that, you got to remember, John said this, if all the things that Jesus did, all the miracles he performed, if they were written down, the world itself could not contain the stories. And so Jesus, he's in the miracle working business, and there's a reason for it. Because it gives him authority. People know he's different than anybody else. Nobody was like Jesus. Well, what was the first miracle that we saw? We saw the water turned into wine, which meant that he had the power over nature. The second miracle, what was that? You guys remember? What was it? Okay, the one last week, the third miracle, it was the ruler from Capernaum. His son that had been sick was healed, and Jesus was 15 to 20 miles away. Last week, our third miracle was there was a man that was at church, at synagogue, and he was demon possessed. And so Jesus is exercising power over all kinds of things, over nature and turning the water into wine, over time and space and physical infirmities, which we're going to get back to tonight. And yet it's 15 to 20 miles away. I mean, that's raw power. And then he's got power over the supernatural. And so tonight, we're going to read our passage. So let's just do this. Let's start with Matthew chapter 8. And then we'll get back to Luke here in just a moment. And the reason I want you to read these is because there's just a little bit of variation in each of these passages. Look with me at chapter 8 of Matthew, verse 14 and 15. And when Jesus was come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother laid and sick of a fever. And he touched her hand. The fever left her, and she arose and ministered unto them. All right, flip forward to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1. I want you to look with me at verse 29. And forthwith, when they were come out of the synagogue, they entered into the house of Simon and Andrew. There's an addition there, all right? So in other words, Matthew says that it was Simon or Peter's house. Now, Mark says that it was Simon and Andrew's house with James and John. In other words, it wasn't James and John's house. They were just invited to go along, right? But Simon's wife's mother lay sick of a fever, and anon, which means immediately, they tell him, Jesus, of her. He came, he took her by the hand, which Matthew said, and lifted her up, which was an addition, and immediately the fever left her, and she ministered unto them. Now go with me to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 4. Look with me at verse 38. And he, Jesus, arose out of the synagogue, and he entered into Simon's house. And Simon's wife's mother was taken with a great fever. Matthew and Mark does not describe it as a great fever, but Luke is a physician. This man's a doctor. We know that because of Colossians tells us that. And so this is a mega fever. In other words, She's not running a fever that's 99.9. No, she's burning up, right? And they besought him. They petitioned him for her, for the mother-in-law. He stood over her and rebuked the fever. That's new. It left her, and immediately she arose and ministered unto them. And so what we have is we've got three events of the same story. Now let me just kind of lay this out for you. When the Sabbath day services are over, it's about noontime. All right? Perhaps that's where the Baptists get the idea that we're supposed to be out at 12 o'clock on Sundays. All right? But the Sabbath day services are over around noon. Well, as they're over, there's been some eventful things that have happened. You have had a demon-possessed man released from that unclean spirit. Well, that's something to talk about. I mean, if we had something happen like that in our service, I guarantee you that would be a topic of conversation at the table when you got ready to eat. And so the man has been released, and we find that in what we talked about last Wednesday night in verse 33 to 37. Well, Jesus is invited by Peter to go back to his house. Now, I don't remember exactly how long it took when we left the synagogue that we walked through in Capernaum over to Peter's house, which was in Capernaum. It couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 minutes. We left that synagogue that Jesus literally taught in. The foundation is there. They built another one on top of it. But the foundation that Jesus was in was there on the bottom. You can see it. It was black rock. The newer synagogue was white. And so we walked just down toward the Sea of Galilee. And then over to the left as you're walking, you see some ruins. And excavations have proven that was Peter's house. Now, there is a huge edifice that was built over the top of it, but it was built off the ground so that you could literally look under it and you can take pictures of it, and you can see the various places where this house is at, and it's a pretty good-sized house. Now, John chapter 1 tells us that Peter and Andrew were born in a place called Bethsaida. That was their original hometown, but probably for economic reasons, there by the Sea of Galilee, they went to Capernaum so that they could basically make money, and I think they were probably pretty good at it. Let's face it, they had multiple ships. They had guys that worked for them. There were four guys in business with each other, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. And I know there were more that worked for them because in John 21, there was Peter and then six other disciples that went back fishing with him. And so what you've got is you've got these guys that have purchased this house. Mark tells us that Andrew owned part of the house. So who lived there with Peter? Well, contrary to Catholic belief, Peter had a wife. You can't have a mother-in-law without having a wife. All right? I mean, that's pretty much an impossibility from you know, what little I know. You know, and I know there's a lot of mother-in-law jokes that go around and all of that, but evidently Peter got along with his fine. I heard about one guy that was in love with this gal, and he went up to her and he said, "Hey, you wanna go to dinner this weekend?" And she said, "Well, let me ask my mother." And the mother said, "Sure, you can go, but I'm gonna have to go with you." She said, "My mom said I can go, but she'll have to go. Is that okay?" "Well, I guess so." So off to dinner they went on that Friday night. You've got the boy and the girl sitting across from each other, and the mother-in-law sitting right there to his right and to her left. And they're just having a pleasant conversation. Well, the boy really liked this girl. And I mean, every time they got ready to go somewhere, she'd say, "Mama, can I go?" "Yes, but I've got to go with you." Well, finally the boy said, "Well, I think I want to get married." So he said, "Would you marry me?" And she said, "Let me ask my mama." And said, "Yes, you can marry him, but I'm going to have to live with you." She said, "Mama said I could marry you, but she's going to have to live with us." So they got married. They went on their honeymoon. The mother-in-law went with them. They got one room. She got another room. They came back, started setting up house. She moved into one bedroom. They had their own bedroom. And that clicked along. Every time they went somewhere, she went. Finally, about a year after they'd been married, they were walking in the park one day. Boy and the girl walking along, a few feet behind them, the mother-in-law just walking along with them. And a lion got loose and attacked the mother-in-law. And the girl screamed, said, honey, do something quick, do something quick. And the guy looked at her and said, "I'm not going to do a thing." He said, "That lion got himself into that. He can get out the best way he can." So Peter evidently didn't have that kind of mother-in-law. She lived with him. So who's in this house? You got Peter. You got his wife, and you say, now wait a minute now, if he was the first pope, which is what the Catholics say, he doesn't have a wife. Well, the scriptures tell us he does have a wife. As a matter of fact, let me tell you something else that I learned about 2 o'clock this morning. I was awake from 2 to 4 this morning just reading, all right? Did you know that, and write this down if you want to check me out, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5. Paul is telling that Corinthian church that it would be okay if he had a wife or his companions had a wife that traveled with them. He said, well, let's just turn to it. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We'll take time to do this. I'll speed up somewhere else. Go to 1 Corinthians 9. Let's look at verse number 5. Have we not power to lead about a sister? The word lead there has the idea of take with us as our companion when we're going and ministering to various places. Don't we have the power to take a sister, a wife, as well as the other apostles? In other words, I'm an apostle called out of due time. I mean, James gets two, Thomas gets two, Matthew gets two. These guys get to have their wives with them. And as the brethren of the Lord, even the Lord's own brothers, guys like James and Jude, they got to take their wives. And then he says, and Cephas, which is what Peter's name was at the beginning. He's called Simon, he's called Cephas, and he's called Peter, all the same guy. And so in all of my years of study, I have never seen that until 2 o'clock this morning. In other words, I've got the right to be married, and if I go to preach somewhere, I got a right to take my wife with me. As a matter of fact, that's probably a good idea. You know, and so he says, yeah, my mother-in-law, she lives with us. And she is sick. So they're born in Bethsaida. Now they live in Capernaum for economic reasons. Well, you've got Peter that's there. You've got his wife that's there. The scriptures is silent on this. We don't know if they had kids or not. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. We really don't know, so we can't jump kids into the mix, but there was a possibility. You've got Andrew that lived there, and we've got a mother-in-law that lived there, but evidently it was large enough because Jesus had his base of operation. He was working out of Peter's house when he was in Capernaum, which was the village of Jesus where he did many, many of his miracles, all right? And so it was his base of operations, and we'll see that again probably next week. Now, let's look at Luke chapter 4, verse 38, and let's kind of wade through the passage very quickly. And he arose out of the synagogue. In other words, the services were over about 12 noon. He goes to Simon's house, and then we see that Simon's mother-in-law was taken with a mega or a great fever. And what do? They besought him. They petitioned him. Now, I wonder if Peter maybe had an ulterior motive saying, if I can get Jesus back to my house, maybe he can help my mother-in-law. Now, we don't know what her name is. We don't know what his wife's name is. There are some people that speculate, and I have no idea where they come up with this. They can't tell you where you come up with it, but some people say his wife's name was Miriam. But nobody can prove that. And so we just identify her as Peter's wife and Peter's mother-in-law. All right? And so they besought the Lord. So when we look at verse 39, if we combined the passages, I want to kind of give you a step-by-step process that took place, how that Jesus did this. Well, we'll read the verse and then I'll give you the process. He stood over her, rebuked the fever. It left her, and immediately she arose and ministered unto them. So the first thing we see that Jesus stands over her. He walks over after they said, she's got a fever. He walks over to the bed where she is laid out. Now remember, they don't have modern medicine. You know, as we were finishing up our study on the book of James, and we talked about when people are anointed with oil, it was really a medicine, and that was about the only medicine they had. They had wine and they had oil, and that was about it. And so they've probably given her everything that they could think of, and a fever, especially a great fever, a mega fever, it probably carried a death sentence with it. I mean, now what do we have? We've got Tylenol. But I'm going to tell you something. You know when aspirin came along? 1899. I looked it up. You know, give them an aspirin. You know, now people say, well, don't really take a lot of aspirin. It'll tear your stomach up. And all I'm thinking is, it's helped a lot of people with aches and pains over the years. And so he stands over her. Luke tells us this. Not only that, he reaches down and he touches her hand. Remember this. Jesus can heal by a touch. But he also can heal with the spoken word. Last week, we don't see him touching this guy. We see him commanding that demon, come out of him. And so whether he is speaking or whether he's touching, he can heal. And so in our passage tonight, we see that he's doing both. And so he's standing over her, and then just with the power of his touch, he can do this, but he reaches down and he takes this lady's hand. When I was leaving the hospital up at Eastside today, and when I was leaving the hospital at Gwinnett Medical today, I got over next to Nancy and I got over next to Miss Helen, and I said, let's pray together, and I took their hand in my hand. And I prayed over both of those ladies at different times. There was no power in these hands. But there was power in Jesus' hands. I'm simply asking God to help them. But Jesus was God in helping them. And in just a few minutes, I'm going to give you six things that Jesus could do that modern-day faith healers cannot do. And so you've got Jesus, and Matthew and Mark says that he touched her hand. Then Luke says he rebuked the fever. Now you think about that for a moment. You don't walk over to a person that's got a fever and go, fever? Leave her alone. You don't talk to something that's inanimate. We don't see a fever. We see the effects of a fever. But Jesus being God, Jesus being omnipotent, he can rebuke a fever just like he rebuked a demon last week. And so he rebukes this fever. When it would have been a death sentence for most people had Jesus not been on the scene. And so he stands over her, he touches her, now he speaks and rebukes the fever. But then Mark tells us that he lifted her up. So in other words, not only did he just touch her hand, but he took her by the hand and helped sit her up. And what happened? Immediately, she was healed. It wasn't that she was healed the next morning. Now let that sink in for a minute. Yesterday, Nancy was in ICU. Today, she's in a room. I think she's getting a little better. Medicine is helping her. The Lord is using the medicine to help her. But had Jesus walked into the room, She's in intensive care, and the next thing you know, she's walking out the door because she don't need it no more. Jesus healed her immediately. In the Gospel of Mark, immediate, straightway are two words that you find often. I mean, Mark just, bam, he gets to the point. And so when Luke uses it in verse 39, immediately, I think it's trying to send us a message that this was something that happened and there wasn't a time lapse so that somebody else could get the credit for it. Jesus commanded it. He touched her. He lifts her up and she's healed. And what happens? She ministers unto them. You know what Mark says? She ministered unto them. You know what Matthew says? She ministered unto them. All three of the evangelists closed the same way, that immediately she got up because she felt great. She's like, I mean, it's lunchtime. In the Bible, they call it dinner. That's what we call it in the South. When I was a kid growing up, my grandparents would say, it's time to eat dinner. They meant lunch. Now we say we're going to eat dinner, and what we mean is we mean supper. All right? I heard a preacher last week on Tuesday night, Dean Herring, he said this. He said he showed up when he went to Idaho to a family's home for dinner. He said we got there at about 5 till 12, and he said they had a look on their face like, what are you doing here? He said, well, I come to eat dinner. So you're early. He said, well, you want us to get in the car and ride around another 10 minutes? What they meant was they wanted him to come like at 5 or 6 o'clock that night, not at 12 o'clock. Well, we have the Lord's Supper, not the Lord's dinner. And so I thought that was pretty humorous of Dean, you know, last night a week ago. And so the Lord, he heals this lady, and immediately all three gospels say she began to serve. I mean, she began to get pots and pans out of the cabinet. She began to have water, and she begins to fix something. Why? Because she wants to feed these guys. I mean, let's face it, you've got a guest which just healed her, so you want to really be nice to him. You got a son-in-law that lets you live with him. You got a guy named Andrew that's kind to everybody that ever meets. He always tells somebody about Jesus. You got a daughter that you love dearly. And then you got two other guys that you know because they've been to your house on numerous occasions because they're friends with Peter and Andrew. And she's like, I need to serve these folks. And let me just say this. We ought to serve God at our house before we try to go out everywhere else. I think that it's one of those things where our homes ought to be a place where Jesus can be honored. And so she is doing her best to honor the Lord. Now let me just give you six things that Jesus can do that the modern faith healers cannot do. I'm talking about guys like Benny Hinn. All right? If you want me to throw a name out there, Benny Hinn's one of them, okay? And you say, well, who are some other ones? Well, look at who Benny hangs out with. All right? Number one, Jesus' healings are instant. They're instant. He doesn't have to say, now come back in 48 hours and you'll be better. You don't find that. Not only that, his healings were for everybody. I read a horrible story. I mean a horrible story that happened in Atlanta. You had a guy that brought a huge faith healing crusade to the Civic Center. And there was a crippled boy that was in a wheelchair. And he was like, if I could just get there. And his mama was like, if I could just get my boy, that guy could heal him. Well, they began to get there several hours early, so that they could try to get into the line. And they had some people, and they were interviewing these people that had come from all over metro Atlanta area and probably all over the state and probably from other states. And they put this boy over in a room that was off from the stage. And that crusade began, and they began to pull these people out, pull these people out, pull these people out. And they'd go, "Oh, I see you've got cancer there," and it'd pop them. And the next thing you know, "Your cancer's healed." Nobody can see that. And they left that little crippled boy in that wheelchair with his mama standing there next to him, and they never called him out onto the stage. You know why? Because they can't make a crippled boy walk. But when Jesus saw a cripple, he took a withered arm, and instantaneously, there's a good arm. He takes a withered leg, and instantaneously, there's a strong leg. He takes a man that's a paralytic, and what does he do? After he heals him, he says, "Hey, take up your bed. You're free to walk. Rise and go walk." And so Jesus' healings were for everybody. Not only that, his healings happened everywhere and at all times. It didn't matter if it was in Capernaum or if it was in Jerusalem. It didn't matter if it was somewhere in North Galilee or if it was somewhere down in the Negev. If Jesus was there, he could do it. If you doubt that, I'll give you a little teaser for next week. If you look with me at verse number 40, it says, "The sun was setting. All they that had any sick with divers or various diseases brought them unto him, and he laid his hands on every one of them and healed them." In other words, everybody at all times got help. His healings were a deliverance from all kind of diseases. There was nothing that he couldn't deliver from. You've got some of these jokers today, and they always want to heal something that nobody can see. But that's not Jesus. Hey, it didn't matter what you had, he could take care of it. And then his healings were total. There wasn't any of this stuff, "Well, you know, you're halfway healed, and you come back next week with another pocket full of money, and I'll heal you the rest of the way." None of that stuff. And the last thing that makes Jesus different is this: he healed people that were dead. Dead. D-E-A-D, dead. Somebody says, "If you'll just have faith, if you just have the faith, God will heal you." Let me tell you something, dead people don't have faith. You know if a dead person's got faith? I don't. Jesus could walk up to somebody that didn't have faith and say, "Get up." And they got up. You remember the widow of Nain? She had a boy that died. Her husband had already died. And Jesus stops the funeral procession, goes over to the boy and says, "Get up." And the boy awakes and he gives him back to his mama. Benny can't do that. And so Jesus can heal when he chose to and when he chooses to. Now, do I think that there's healings that go on today? Yes. But it's because Jesus chooses to do it, not because some man commanded him to do it. And so when we look at this story, we see a great God. We see a Jesus that just has compassion on everybody. I mean, he's got compassion on a man at the synagogue. He's got compassion on a boy that's 20 miles away. He's got compassion on a mother-in-law. Why? Jesus just loves people. Let me close with this last phrase. I want you to look with me at the last few words of verse 39 again. "Immediately she arose and ministered unto them. Immediately, she arose and ministered unto them. I believe one of the marks of true discipleship is serving. We don't find her saying, well, you know, I'm just tired. Honey, you're going to have to fix it for your husband and his friends. You're just going to have to do that. Oh, no, 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 no. She knows how sick she was. And she knows how good she feels right now because the Son of God has touched her and he's rebuked that fever. That was a great fever. And she says, the least I can do is serve the Lord and these men. I believe that if we have truly become disciples of the Lord, we want to serve in whatever capacity that we have the ability to do. I was so proud of our church at that conference, and I've been so proud of our choir at that conference and in the Easter program for the serving and the sacrifice that they made to make those three days happen. Now, be honest with you, I've been tired ever since. Today was the first day that I really felt like going and getting it since Easter Sunday and since that preacher's conference. But I have been so proud of our people. We had 45 to 50 people that were over there in that gym just serving people, making these preachers feel welcome. I had another email that came in today. I read it. It was from a preacher's wife, and she said, I just want you to know, and I please let your people know how thrilled it was to just be there. We were so encouraged and we needed it. I mean, that was just one more that came in today. I had a couple of phone calls Monday or Tuesday. I had a letter or so last week. I had phone calls last week. I'm telling you, our people served, and that was a good thing. That was a good thing. And when Jesus has done something for us, we ought to want to jump in and do something for him with both feet. All right? Let's stand together.